Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Sarah Shays has been a longtime observer in how endemic corruption in places like Afghanistan, Iraq, Egypt, and Nigeria have eroded those societies' economies and government and harmed their citizens' rights and livelihoods. In her books, The Punishment of Virtue and Thieves of State, she documented corruption's effect on people, neighborhoods, businesses, and national institutions alike in these developing nations. But in her latest book, she looks at corruption here at home. Not of one present presidential administration, but of a slow creeping set of networks, aided and abetted by both political parties, where private and public sector elites, the super rich and those gaming the systems, have seated the judiciary, watered down regulators, and used money to control the political process. In fact, she writes, the same type of networks that wreaked so much havoc and pessimism in those developing countries are also at play here in the U.S. Her book is titled On Corruption in America and What is at Stake. It's published by Knopf. If Sarah Shays' name sounds familiar, it's because she was a reporter for NPR from 1996 to 2002. She left NPR to help rebuild Afghanistan after covering the war for the network. There, she helped rebuild homes and a dairy cooperative. From there, she became a special advisor on corruption for Generals David McKiernan and Stanley McChrystal in Afghanistan, and later to the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen. She's also worked at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and she's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Sarah Shays, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you've been advising defense officials and NGOs on corruption's impact on places like Afghanistan, Iraq, the countries of the Arab Spring. What made you decide to look at corruption here at home?
It was creeping up on me, I have to say. When I wrote my last book, Thieves of State, which really was focused on the countries that you mentioned, I did include a sort of epilogue that was suggesting, hey, it ain't just them. It's us. And the message of that book was that uncontained systemic corruption drives its victims to extremes. And I focused on the extreme of extremist religion, violent, militant religion, which I was finding as a constant across those countries that you mentioned. And so there was a lightly brushed warning to the United States, hey, this ain't just them. And if we're not careful, we might be driven to extremes also. And all I can say is that as I watched what started to unfold here, I sort of thought, wow, I thought we had a little more time. You know, I didn't think that we were going to be driven to the extremes that we're now experiencing quite so quickly. But there was a turning point, which I mention in On Corruption, which is the unanimous Supreme Court decision which overturned the corruption conviction of former Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell. And that was so shocking to me, not just the way the Supreme Court went, but the fact that it was unanimous. I mean, the deeds that McDonnell had done were egregious. You know, I mean, he had accepted a whole bunch of gifts in turn for helping, you know, what looks like a kind of quack doctor, tobacco guy who wanted to convert into the more lucrative world of pharma. And the actions were obviously quid pro quo bribery. You know, a jury of peers had convicted McDonald. The appeals court had upheld the conviction unanimously, and here the Supreme Court overturns it unanimously. And what that was telling me is that we have reached a breaking point. This decision came down in the end of June 2016, right? So we're in the height of the campaign, of the presidential campaign. You've got Brexit has just happened. That's the scene. And I'm saying there is a rupture between the way ordinary Americans across the political spectrum understand corruption and the way, you know, the country's elites do. What is a more elite institution than the U.S. Supreme Court, right? Right. Regardless of the 5-4 or partisan divides that, you know, seem to occupy a lot of our attention, it turns out that there's an underlying unanimity there on a lot of this type of issue. And I just felt like, my goodness, this rupture between how the elites and regular folks see this issue is going to be incredibly dangerous. And sure enough.
Right. There was a line, I believe, in the majority decision which said, by upholding this conviction, we would be criminalizing politicians' normal behavior. I'm paraphrasing, but I think there was a line in there that said, this is what politicians do. They provide service for constituents. And if we uphold this, we're upholding, you know, we're basically criminalizing.
We're criminalizing politics. You are so right.
I remember this decision. I remember somebody at the time said, this is basically said, the only way you can do quid pro quo corruption is if the person that hands the politician the bribe says, I want a quid pro quo for this, and I want you to do this. And they would have to state it that baldly to get a conviction in corruption cases anymore.
I spoke to a prosecutor who was in the public integrity section when I spoke to him. He transferred out because of this. He said, you have to be really bad to be caught for corruption anymore. And then he said, and I don't mean really, really corrupt. I mean really bad at being corrupt. You have to be stupid. So, yeah. And so what we have experienced in this country has been a expansion of what any regular human being would consider corrupt activities and practices at the same time as there has been a concerted and deliberate campaign to narrow the legal definition of corruption. And this book on corruption does trace that without going too deep into the technical legal details. There is a chapter that traces this campaign, because it clearly was a campaign. And what is remarkable has been the unanimity of the justices in participating, frankly.
Right. Let me ask you a very quick question about the impact of that decision before we talk about the rest of the book, because this is only a little small sampling of the book that we're talking about. Has that decision had an impact on behavior in federal officials since 2016? Given all we know about the last 4 years of, you know, the executive branch and others in government today?
I can't point to causation, right? What I can point to is lack of enforcement against corrupt officials as a result of this decision. So one very famous one was Democratic Senator Robert Menendez, who was on trial. And the charges were dropped. Now, what he had done was help out a doctor who had committed and went to jail for millions of dollars worth of Medicaid fraud by prescribing unnecessary eye operations to elderly patients. I'm like, is this what we have descended to in this country? That's an okay way of making money? And the doctor went to jail. Menendez, who helped him out in a variety of ways, is a kind of Democratic Party champion. So there you have it on the Democratic side. On the Republican side, you've got Chris Christie. And the egregious closing of two lanes on the busiest bridge on the planet, again, unanimously, the Supreme Court overturned the conviction of members of his staff. So when you have that kind of messaging happening from the only body that is capable of, I want to say, sort of slapping down this type of behavior, basically that's a green light. Now, whether other corrupt officials that we have been witnessing over the last 4 years have been, you know, have had a weather eye to Supreme Court decisions, I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised if their lawyers haven't had a weather eye to those decisions.
Well, your book, On Corruption in America and What is at Stake, begins with a very long view of corruption, beginning with the story of Jesus throwing out the money changers. You go through the Gilded Age and a variety of other corrupt eras in history, and then a short portrait of Joseph Kennedy, the patriarch of the Kennedy political dynasty. What does he embody within your narrative?
May I put that question on pause? This is like your worst nightmare in an interviewee, right?
Uh-huh.
I'd just like to go back a second to some of the earlier points that you mentioned in the wind-up to the question, which is to say Jesus and before Jesus, Midas.
Midas, right.
These are not throwaways to say, golly gee, corruption's been with us forever. I selected these examples for very specific reasons. Midas, it turns out, so we all know about the myth of Midas, and what's interesting is today Midas is seen as a positive. You know, the Midas touch is almost, you know, President Trump wrote a book called The Midas Touch, you know, as though it's a good thing. If you get down and think about what Midas does, he wishes that everything he touched turns to gold. He turns everything of intrinsic value, the food he wishes to eat. In Hawthorne's poem, he turns his daughter into gold. Everything of our deepest intrinsic values is converted into a kind of marketable commodity. So what I discovered that was really fascinating is there was a real Midas, and he lived right around the time of the invention of money. Money as a specific, different way of hoarding as well as exchanging value. And money is a very specific thing. It's different from heaps of wheat and stuff like that. And Aristotle, whom I also mentioned, gets into that difference. What's the difference between acquiring a decent livelihood, which you can do with fig trees and wheat and things like that, and sheep and flocks? You have to tend it, you have to take care of it, and there's a limit. But with money, you can start making money for money, and it launches a race with no finish line, because you start measuring your social standing by money, which is what we're doing today. So I just like to kind of anchor here. There is something called the Midas disease, which is when you wish to convert everything into gold or money, if you will. And money today isn't even coins, it's electronic signals.
Right.
So the Midas disease converts everything of intrinsic greatest value to us as humans, as societies, as cultures, into zeros in bank accounts. That's right. The Midas disease, and it's dangerous. What Jesus does was notice that people infected with the Midas disease, which was properly money at that point, the Old Testament is written in a time without money. So wealth is more seen as something positive. In the New Testament, you know, coins are in, you've got the Midas disease, and what's happened is you've got coalitions of networked individuals who are rigging the system. That's what's going on in the temple. And I was astonished to discover what the temple looked like at the time, which is basically a Trump Tower. I mean, it's gold-plated, you know? I mean, I'm like, are you kidding me? You know, and it's got the army in it, and it's got the seat of government, and it's got the Supreme Court, and it's got the money changers. And what Jesus does is he collects a coalition, an egalitarian coalition that is banded together across all the identity divides, and he walks up to the temple, and he overturns those tables. He commits what for him, for the Prince of Peace, is a pretty violent act. It's not violent, no one dies, but it's pretty dramatic. And that is the moment at which the hierarchy says, we got to kill him.
Right.
So I just want to anchor, I think that our society, our science-based society, and God loves science, you know, I mean, but we have lost touch with some of the value of some of the sacred stories in our past. And here we have a Greek myth, a philosopher, and a sacred text from the Bible, and they really have a lot to communicate that I think is important to us now. So having said all that, and I apologize, let me turn to Joe Kennedy.
Right.
Because he's really interesting. So I paused on Joe because I was looking at the Gilded Age, which, broadly speaking, is the period from about 1870 until, and I carry it further than most other people do, until the late 1930s. And that is the period in which networked systemic corruption, whereby integrated networks of businessmen, politicians, and sometimes out-and-out criminals, really controlled the levers of economic and political power, and not just in the United States, but across the industrialized world, and irrespective of political system, which I found quite distressing. This hit the German Empire just as fully as it hit the French Third Republic and the United States of America. And it was a period when the Midas disease was in full pandemic, right? And you got, you know, I mean, I'm speaking to you from south of the village of Pawpaw, West Virginia. My hills over here were completely deforested. You had the total deforestation of Appalachia. You had, you know, the extermination of the bison. You had the genocide against Native Americans. You had the beginnings of the oil economy. I mean, the kind of devastation that was wrought on the almost indescribably valuable miracle of the planet that we're given to live on was unleashed in the Gilded Age. And the, as I say, genocide of Native Americans, the Jim Crow laws come in, the really vicious return to subjugation of African Americans, especially in the South, but not only in the South. All of that is happening in this period. So Joe Kennedy really interested me because his personality was perfectly a Gilded Age personality. When you start looking at the details of his life, he lived exactly like a Carnegie. He didn't give a damn about anything except his own immediate family and money. What's fascinating about his story is he never achieved the social stature and standing that a Carnegie or a Mellon or a Rockefeller did. And what I came to was that he was born about two decades too late. He was born in the 1880s at the height of the Gilded Age syndrome. But he comes of age at a period when the tide was turning. And the tide was turning. I know a lot of people talk about pendulum swings. I don't think pendulums swing just automatically. I think there was a swing. But what caused it was the absolutely devastating calamities that were brought on by, you know, the dominance of a bunch of people who were infected with the Midas disease. You know, like they created systemic corruption. They ran the world according to systemic corruption. And what they brought on first was a series of stock market crashes followed by economic depressions in the late 19th century. Starting in 1873 and just bang, bang, bang.
Yeah, 1893, 1904, 1907.
Exactly.
Yeah,
1888,
just a whole,
I think there was one, too. You're exactly right. And so it's like this tolling bell until it jams us right into the Great Depression. Before that, we had World War One. And what's so interesting about Joe Kennedy is he doesn't go off to war. So he's not touched by the real calamity that people like him had helped bring about. He just sees the money-making opportunities. Same thing with the Depression. He got out of the market before it crashed. Then he starts short-selling, doing everything that brought the Depression on. You know, I'm not saying he personally caused it to linger.
But he profited.
But that's he profited, and practices like his, when there were enough people doing what he was doing, which was short-selling and things like that, that is what prolonged the Depression, among other things. And so you have a person who's living at a period where calamities are beginning to change the ethos. But he himself is untouched by those calamities, and so he doesn't change. And therefore, he is never really exalted because he was too late for a straight Gilded Age guy, and he couldn't become a post-Gilded Age guy, which, for example, Roosevelt was. Roosevelt, Franklin, coming out of an elite background, nevertheless was touched, and whether it was from the way World War I hit him, I mean, I'm not a psychologist and I'm not, you know, a historian of this period, but I'm just playing with some ideas, or was it his own personal difficulties with polio that caused him to be opener, and he was the man of the moment. But it is a cautionary tale that we weren't guaranteed to get Roosevelt.
Right.
And under a Joe Kennedy, America might have turned into a very different country. He also, as ambassador to Great Britain, was in negotiations with Goering, or Goering's guy, about providing a loan of gold to the Nazi government.
Yeah. My guest today is Sarah Shays. She is a former senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She's an author, a former NPR reporter, author of several books, including The Punishment of Virtue, Thieves of State, about corruption, and her latest book is On Corruption in America and What is at Stake. We spent a lot of time on sort of the prologue to the the main point of the book, which is that I think you referred to the Greek mythic figure of the Hydra, which was also very popular in the Gilded Age as showing the sort of multi-headed figure of connections between wealth, between networks, between political power, between power of the courts, power of public safety. And we find ourselves really in another, perhaps, Gilded Age. A lot of people make the same comparison. And you write on how corruptive power has been used in all of those institutions in the last 30 to 40 years. But you also write about the backlash to the Gilded Age. People striking, people in the countryside. What can we learn from the backlash to the Gilded Age?
A couple of things. So you're exactly right. The networks, I mean, often we will talk about government institutions and we'll talk about corporations. Let's not forget that those are fictions, right? I mean, those are constructs. All of these things are made up of men and women. And so the network, the notion of a network is a really important idea also. And this is people who have had childhoods together, who have worked together in a small job so that they make forge very close contacts. It's social networks, but real social networks, not the online kind. It's people, and I was introduced to that in Afghanistan, where people carry network maps around in their heads because that's how they are able to situate strangers in a kind of human geography. And these networks very much work that way. They cycle their personnel into and out of different, what we might consider different sectors, meaning public sector, as you suggested, judiciary branch, you know, political office, private sector, meaning industry, also meaning philanthropy. So that is a very important element of this. You know, NGOs and nonprofits and so-called charities are very much part of this kind of galaxy, as are out-and-out criminals. I mean, very often you have thugs. You have, I've seen in a lot of other countries, you know, they're called thugs. They're called area boys in Nigeria. They're called, you know, assassins in Honduras. You have these, often they're former military people who are not officially constituted in any way, but they are violence that can be called upon by members of the network in a plausibly deniable way. So the networks are multi-talented, and that's part of what makes them so resilient and so adaptable and so difficult to actually overcome. And the Hydra, you know, feature is that they will even allow one or two of their heads to get chopped off, you know, and two more will spring back. And that's what, again, makes them very dangerous. And I've looked at anti-corruption, you know, uprisings around the world, and boy, are we living in the middle of them. I mean, every place from South Korea to, you know, Lebanon to Honduras and Guatemala, Burkina Faso I looked at. I mean, it's everywhere in the last 5 or 10 years. And unfortunately, too often, not always, but too often, people go home. That was the case in the Arab Spring. People basically went home once the top person, and usually it was a guy, top guy's head was lopped off. Well, Hydras don't stay dead. And that's a real object lesson for people who seek to curb the corruption in the American political and economic system today, is one individual is not, that's not going to do it. So that's why I looked back at the Gilded, the first Gilded Age, to see, well, what else was going on? What were people, what did protesters try to do then? And I discovered just a very rich world of opposition to this way of structuring our politics and economy. And it ranged, as you said, from labor strikes in the really grisly working conditions of steel mills and railroads in particular, but not only, across to innovative, radical political ideology, a lot of which is a lot more interesting when you read what its proponents were actually saying rather than use the name of their movements like anarchist or socialist. You know, all of these names get branded in very negative ways. But if you look at what people were recommending or playing around with, it's really interesting. And for me, remarkable was the Farmers Alliance all through, you know, your region, West Texas, north into, you know, Missouri and those areas, which was really the West, the settled West at the time. And here you have people who are living on the prairie and living, you know, in rough parts of the world and very disconnected from each other, and yet they would meet at the local schoolhouse, and they had so many newspapers that were being distributed by the U.S. mail and things like that, and they were doing this incredible self-education about what the heck was going on, why they couldn't make, you know, even make a living as small farmers. And they came up with really sophisticated solutions, many of which were eventually enacted, like direct election of senators, like universal suffrage, like a flexible currency, and some that did not get enacted. So all of this was really inspiring, except that I noticed none of it worked, not when the movements were active. It took these huge calamities. And so the lesson that that tells me, and it's a bit of a Cassandra one, is we better get on the stick. Because we don't want to go through the 21st century version of two world wars with two genocides, mass starvation in Europe, a pandemic that makes, you know, coronavirus look like peanuts, plus a global economic meltdown, plus a nuclear bomb, okay? Like, that's what it took in the 20th century to yank us out of the grasp of these hydras.
And I'll actually throw out another depressing thing, which you write in the book, is that every time there was a financial or political sort of corrective after the excesses, almost immediately the forces that perhaps drove it were trying to downplay the significance and lessen the correctives. We saw after the mortgage-based security scandal, you know, people were going after the institutions that were created out of that.
Absolutely.
After the savings and loan debacle in the 1980s, again, prohibitions on banks were routinely thrown aside after 10 years or less.
Exactly, exactly. So the Hydra is viciously attacking any actions by government that are designed to defend the people from the Hydra. And they really work hard. This Hydra really works hard. You're exactly right. And the other thing the Hydra does is it profits from crisis. So you have the whole ecosystem of what we might call vulture capitalists or distressed asset people, and they, of course, pounce on crisis, and that's what Joe Kennedy was, right? You're snapping up the assets that people are forced to sell cheap because they're so desperate, and they're also jumping on government spending wherever that's taking place, which often happens in moments of crisis. And that, again, is something that we're experiencing today.
The name of the book is On Corruption in America and What is at Stake? It's published by Knopf. Sarah Shays, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Author and former journalist Sarah Shays speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa, the former NPR reporter and assistant on corruption to Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Mike Mullen. Its latest book is titled On Corruption in America and What is at Stake? It's published by Knopf. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.